You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet, and story is everything. You were just listening to Hot Texas by the Hot Texas Swing Band and our friend Alex Dormont. And
we're just delighted that you're with us tonight. We're ready for another terrific show. Yeah. Who's our guest?
Our guest is J. David Bethel, and we're going to talk about this book, Mapping the Night, a thriller.
And I see that he is coming online, and I'm just going to go ahead and say hello to David, to his friends. Hello, hello, there he is. And of course, we're holding up this engaging psychological thriller, Mapping the Night. Welcome, David.
Okay.
David, where are you joining us tonight? Are you with us? Sometimes this happens to our listening audience. He is joining us from a distance, and we can see him on camera, and I have a sense that he's going to be dialing back in. So what did you like about this book, Jim?
You know, this is an interesting book, and it does give me a chance. You know, there's a number of themes here, and we're talking about a serial killer or a thriller, but, you know, there's a love story here. There's serial killer, international intrigue and espionage. There's revenge. And it's a great travelogue of New York City.
Yes. And we said that we were reading it sitting on the edge of our seats. And were we ever, weren't we? We read this pretty quickly, actually.
You know, it's a real thriller, but, you know, there are humorous parts to it. And human interest, and it's not necessarily a slasher book, right. So you can feel comfortable reading it at, without getting too squeamish here.
Yes, yes. And what was a favorite? Did you have a favorite character in the book?
You know, I really like, there are several characters to like, but, you know, I like Maddie because she had a great outlook on life, considering her dismal circumstances. And it's kind of a story of two people finding themselves, both were isolated from society and shunned away. And it's kind of neat the way they found themselves.
And I think that David is here to join us. David, we've just been chatting about the book. Welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. And thank you for asking me to join you and your followers.
Yeah. Well, we're so happy. And, you know, as you know, every one of our guests know, we do read the book. And it's very helpful if we have to just sort of run, you know, we just have to chat about something for a few minutes. It's never a problem for us, is it, Jim?
We can talk about the whole book without David.
Oh, no. We hate
to say that.
Oh, no.
We're glad you're here.
David, where are you joining us from tonight?
Good. As I said, it's good to be here. Thank you very much.
Yeah. And where are you joining us from?
Well, as it happens, I'm in Washington, D.C. I live in Florida, just in the Orlando area. But we're here visiting friends and family in Washington, D.C. We lived here for about 28 years or so, and then went back down to Miami and then ended up in the Orlando area. And now we're back in D.C. for 3 or 4 months.
Well, we're so happy. We're sort of coast to coast tonight again with LA Talk Radio and us in Albuquerque and you on the East Coast. So covering a lot of time zones here. Before we get, Jim has a bio. Yes.
We should read the
bio. We're back on track.
We have a bio and a little quote at the same time about the book. We'll start with the bio. John David Bethel is an award-winning author whose novels include Evil Town, Unheard Of, Holding Back the Dark, and A Washington Trilogy, to name a few. For members of Congress, he has worked as both a press secretary and speech writer. He graduated Phi Beta Kappa from Tulane and now lives in Washington, D.C., right at the moment. Now, we have a quote from the book. It kind of sets it up to some degree. And it's about New York City, and it's by, this quote comes from Eileen Prado, a special FBI agent. And she says, "What a wonderful city. I bet you can find any kind of food or whatever else you wanted. And the people, is this amazing or what? Don't see this in D.C., the most buttoned-up city in the world. Here, if it's on their minds, it comes out of their mouths. In D.C., it has to be vetted by a press secretary after it's written by a speechwriter, and that's after the words are tested by a focus group." This is refreshing.
Well, it's true. It's true. This is a lot different from New York.
Yeah. So tell us, David, a little bit more about, we covered just a couple of highlights of your background, but tell us a little bit more and then maybe how and when you started writing.
Well, my journey to writing started with reading, but I'm that's probably true of many writers. My journey was a little bit different, I think. My dad was a Foreign Service officer, which means until I was about 14, mm-hmm. we spent our lives traveling. I didn't live in the United States until I was 14. And while we were traveling, I would miss large swaths of school, sometimes as much as a couple of months. And my parents insisted that I read. They had a reading list for me, and I would read voraciously. And I don't know, I guess I just decided sometime I enjoyed reading so much, and it took me into these various, you know, places all over the world, including the United States, which, of course, I was fascinated with being a young kid overseas, not really living in the United States. Long story short, I decided I'm going to give it a shot. And when I wrote my first short story when I was in fifth grade, I remember that. And my dad took it to his office. He had it typed up. Put in a little, you know, one of those plastic containers to cover things and gave it back to me. And I was so proud of myself. I was a published author, and I've been writing since.
That's
great.
That's just a wonderful story. When you worked on Capitol Hill for a while, any interesting assignment that you had that kind of calls out to you from your years there?
Well, probably the one that sticks with me the most is that I was lucky enough to work for Senator Paul Axel from Nevada, who was a governor of Nevada for a number of years. And he was very close with Ronald Reagan, who was governor of California. And they had a personal as well as professional friendship. Long story short, Laxalt ended up being Reagan's campaign manager. And I got to work with Laxalt on the speech that nominated Reagan for president. So I'm kind of proud about that.
That's great. Mm-hmm. That's great.
We won't ask you who you're voting for this year. We're staying totally.
Oh, no, please don't.
Away from that topic.
What's going on in Washington now, I don't understand. I don't want to have anything to do with. You know, I'm glad that I'm retired and writing novels.
So, we're talking about writing while you're in Washington. Do you have a lot of deadlines? Was there a lot of stress to some of your writing?
Well, I suppose there was stress. But, you know, when you're in the middle of it and you're working 8-10 hours a day, you really don't think about it as stress. Mm-hmm. It's just you move from one assignment to another. Now, there are particular times when the Senate is in session, for instance, and all of a sudden he'll get called, your senator, Senator Laxalt, would get called to the Hill, and I'd have to write something really quick that he could he could say on the, you know, that he could introduce a bill or talk about a bill he was voting for. So I guess in that sense there was. But again, when you're in the middle of it, you really don't think about it.
You know, for a politician, they have to have a lot of trust in you. If you're given an assignment to write or something that they're going to talk about, they kind of hope that you write it the way they think.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have to almost do a mind meld with the person that you're writing for. And I was, I was fortunate. Laxalt and I happened to think and write alike. It got to the point where I didn't even have to have him edit most things. I would write it and give it to him before he was walking onto the dais. So that was very fortunate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
One of the things that you mentioned when we spoke the other night is to consider, if you're a writer and you're looking for when am I going to write, and how am I going to write, and how am I going to make an income at writing? Not everybody thinks about writing what you made a career out of.
I discovered that. It's unusual, I suppose. I discovered that when I was an intern on Capitol Hill, when I was still in college. I worked for a senator on Capitol Hill, and after a couple of weeks, they discovered that I could put sentences together. So they had me writing things, you know, and I discovered, I thought to myself, looked around, I said, well, all these guys, they're giving speeches all the time. They're testimony on before committees. They have to, you know, introduce bills and so on and so forth. So I discovered my place on Capitol Hill. I was very fortunate because most people who consider themselves writers or want to be writers never get the opportunities that I had.
Mm-hmm. So let's shift gears and get into this book.
All right.
Mapping the Night. So tell us a little bit about how did this book come about?
Okay. Well, like most of my novels, there's a kernel of truth in the novel. And what happened was about a year before I started writing Mapping the Night, I saw a report in the New York Times one of their crime sections about a woman who was discovered deceased in her apartment by some policemen. And the long story short, what happened was she and her son were very noticeable around the apartment complex all the time. They didn't see her for a couple of days. They asked the cops to do a welfare check. The cops went in and they discovered that she had been killed and she was lying in her bed. And her young son, who was about 5 or 6 years old, they discovered him applying ice to her forehead because he said, well, you know, every time I got sick, this is what she did for me. Yeah. And I want her to get well. So I was, you know, this is the only thing that I can think of. Of course, that's a very haunting scene. That stuck with me. And I did a little research on, you know, where it went from there. And it discovered that when they finally found out who had done it, it was discovered that he was a serial offender. He did this to a number of women, single women with young boys. And the other aspect of this that also appears in the novel is that he had his signature, so to speak, of every serial killer has a signature, something he does that's different that identifies him as the perpetrator. And he would clean houses. He would clean the apartments to with an inch of their life. No dust, nothing. The place looked immaculate. And so that stuck out too. So I kind of put everything together, had a recipe, and then went from there. And then you have Mapping the Night.
So when you were writing this book, who did you think would be your reader?
Well, there's a large audience for the genre of psychological thrillers, and all those who enjoy true crime or any kind of crime, not crime fiction, of course. And then there's also the mystery fan. So all of that cohort would be the ones that would be interested in Mapping the Night.
Yeah.
What's the story with the title, Mapping the Night?
Well, you know, it's like most of my titles. I'm just writing away, and then I will write a sentence with the words. I wrote a sentence with the words Mapping the Night in it. And I thought to myself, well, that's kind of interesting. So I just took it as my title. And the same thing with Holding Back the Dark and these other novels. I will be writing away and a sentence will come and the words will come to me and I'll say, well, that'll make a good title. But I never go into a novel with a title in mind.
Yeah.
You know, looking at the picture of this lone solitary figure there in the dark, is that kind of special? Did you just come up with that, or did the publisher put that out, or how did that work?
No, the way this kind of interesting. I was looking at various photographs of New York to try and get, you know, a flavor for myself to get me in the mood and all that. And there was a public site where you could get pictures of New York for free. Okay. And I was looking through it, and that one came up to me, and I thought, this might make a good cover for the novel. So I sent it to the publisher. I sent a bunch of them to the publisher, and that's the one he selected for the cover.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's a good color picture.
What, David, we're going to break away in just a moment for a very short spot. But before we do that, and then we're going to come back and talk more in depth. But what would you say is the difference as a writer between writing a mystery and writing a psychological thriller or a thriller? Is there a...
Yeah, there's a difference. A thriller does not have to be a mystery, but very often a mystery is a thriller. For instance, in the Mapping the Night, there's no mystery about who did it. The prospect, the unique thing about a thriller is why did this person do it, and how do they discover that it's him? But there's no mystery about who did it.
Okay, when we come back, we will be taking an in-depth look at this psychological thriller, Mapping the Night. But here's a word from one of the places that you can find J. David Bethel's book, Mapping the Night, as well as all of the books from our Rendezvous with a Writer featured authors, the Out West Shop affiliate bookshop.org page. And when we come back, I'll be doing a little reading aloud. So stay tuned. Don't go away. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We're chatting with J. David Bethel. And this book right here, Mapping the Night. Yeah, you're going to read some, right?
I am. David, I hope that that's okay with you. I just felt that this book, your writing is so terrific, especially the scenes, many of the scenes that go on in New York City. And I just found myself having to read aloud to Jim all the time. And I'd say, did you get to this chapter yet? Did you read his description of the palms or whatever it might be? So if you will indulge me, I will read a little bit. And I'd like you to just take a moment to set this up. The scene is with at the moment, nameless character who there's a chapter called Walkabout. And I'm lifting this passage from Walkabout. What would you like to say about this chapter?
Okay, well, Warren Winston is the young man that you're going to be reading about. He's a major character in the novel, and he has a skin condition which prevents him. I mean, it's a long name, and I won't even begin to explain it or to try and talk about it. Yeah. Well, I can talk about it, but I can't pronounce it. He has a skin condition that prevents him from going into sunlight. Actually, any light gives it. He's allergic to light, so he can't go out. If he does, his skin gets burned, and he will get infection. So he spends most of his time out and about around New York between the times of about, I don't know, 12 at night until the sun comes up. And he sees unique things in New York that most people don't, because most people are out during the day. He's out during the night. He meets different people. He sees different things. And he sees things from a unique perspective that most people don't. So that is a good introduction, I think, to what you're about to read.
Okay. So this night, he made his way from the park to the theater district. A bit of a hike, but he enjoyed the activity of the stagehands bustling in and out of the buildings, busy doing whatever it was they did after every show. The front doors to the theaters were usually open when he passed by, as cleaning crews came and went, allowing him a peek inside. He strode past the Eugene O'Neill Theater, Henry Miller's, the Long Acre, L'Enfantine, the Majestic, and the Music Box. We've been there. His favorite was the Al Hirschfeld Theater. It had a freestanding ticket booth like the ones in old movie theaters and columns with ornate Moorish designs. The line of glass doors were framed in bronze. He could picture huge spotlights piercing the heavens and limousines depositing women in gowns and men in top hats and tails at the curb as people crowded the sidewalk, waving bits of paper, seeking autographs, while reporters with flash cameras and small notepads rushed forward for a word or two. To him, it was magical. He prized his walkabouts, an opportunity to hike the empty streets, take in the wealth of window dressings behind the glass of closed storefronts, walk through canyons of buildings where the stars were permitted only slivers of the sky. The beeping of his phone alarm, warning him of coming daylight, caught him in the middle of the block across from the Fifth Avenue entrance to the plaza. There, a man stood erect, not moving a muscle, staring up at the building. The figure remained stock still as if cemented to the sidewalk. He remained with his arms pressed to his side for some time before stretching his arms wide and beginning a cross-legged dance down the block, his attention riveted on the building. At the end of the block, the man bowed deeply and walked away. It left, he felt himself smiling. Could be the strange man was paying homage to celebrated piece of the city's history. There were few who truly appreciated the roots of the plaza as part of that history. He did. He had lived in the building all his life.
Thank you. Very, very, very good.
You know, at this point, I didn't know. As I'm reading this, and I think, which one of these two is the villain?
Yeah, it's kind of early in the book. We don't want to, it's not really a spoiler alert, but my first thought was, is this a vamp? What's the deal with unnamed, although you of course did share his name. He is one of my favorite characters. I would love to walk New York with Warren Winston.
Well, you'd learn very, very different things as you have read. He has a history. He's a real compendium of historical minutiae about the city and he can even tell you when the walls were built around Central Park and why they were built at an angle and not straight. It's that kind of thing that I really enjoyed researching for the novel.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had found one about, was that St. Patrick's Cathedral?
Oh, was the many locations you described, you know, the little facets of information, like I used to work in the city by a couple of days a week. I'm familiar with most of the buildings and the places you talk about, in particular St. Patrick's Cathedral. But when you talk about those doors weighing 9,000 pounds each, how did they get
them
up there?
I know, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? I mean, this is the kind of research that I enjoy doing. I enjoy research as much as I do writing, I think. Mm-hmm. And when I came, I knew I wanted to have St. Patrick's Cathedral in there. And I did a little, as you can see, I did a little research. And when I got to that fact about the doors, I was just amazed.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I don't put a key in and a keypad, you know.
You know, as we're talking about the walkabout here, Warren's doing, I'm reading and I'm thinking, you know, this guy's in the middle of the night and he's walking through Central Park. Now, when I used to go into New York City, you didn't do that unless you knew exactly what you were doing.
Well, which is what made, I think, his walking about in Central Park so interesting, and the characters that he found when he was in Central Park. And I've talked to people now, they say that's a little overdone. Really, you can walk through Central Park at night as long as you're aware and as long as you're careful. But I wanted to put Warren in situations that maybe he wasn't so careful and he wasn't so aware, and he would meet these strange people. And of course he became friendly with them. He knew them and they knew him. So they didn't bother him.
Yes.
Well, he seemed to have a personality that he seemed to be able to handle situations that the rest of us probably wouldn't handle very well.
He's likable.
And he escaped because he had some bad guys after him and he handled that too.
Well, again, you're talking about a man who's basically, his whole life is fraught with danger and with everything. So I'm sure he has a different perspective than the most of us do. He handles things differently simply because of the condition that he's living with.
Mm-hmm. So obviously you have been on the Upper East Side of Manhattan during Christmas.
Oh, yes. I have. When I was a kid and living overseas, the idea of America was so special to me. And my mother lived in Brooklyn, New York, and we would come home on home leave, usually twice a year, sometimes in the summer and then often at Christmas, because that's when I had time off from school, myself and my sister. And so they'd bring us to New York, and we would go to, Macy's with the huge model train that they had running around the whole Macy's. And I was just magic. I was just magical. And my parents would take us to Radio City Music Hall, the Rockettes, and then right across the street. I'm so old, I can tell you that I remember the Automat across the street. So, it was just a very special time.
Yeah. Now, there are three victims. And they each happens in a different building. So quickly, we start with the Gramercy, right?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that building, or why did we start there in that building? Any reason?
No particular reason, really. I had to start somewhere. So I started there, but I wanted to have buildings. I think another building is the Dakota, and of course we have the Plaza. So I wanted special buildings that meant that people who might not New York would say, oh, the Dakota, that's right. That's where John Lennon lived and where he was assassinated. It's that kind of thing. Of course, the Plaza, everybody knows the Plaza. So I wanted buildings that, even if the reader did not know anything about the New York, they would recognize those names.
And I think that's very true, even though we have this, kind of a little bit of connection at the same time. If you did not, you will now. You will want to take a trip. Do you want to ask about?
We got something here about the FBI and CIA, you seem like you're pretty familiar with those folks.
Generally, as I said, I worked on the Hill. So in kind of macro terms, big picture terms, I knew people who worked for the FBI. We have reasons every once in a while to deal with them and to deal with people with the CIA. The senator, if I recall, Senator Laxalt, had a seat on the Foreign Relations Committee. So, the CIA would often come and testify. I didn't know anything specifically, these people are not modeled after people I knew from the FBI or the CIA, but I did enough research to understand how things are done when they're looking for a serial offender, what they look for and how they go about identifying them. And in the CIA part of it, how they deal with what they're dealing with in the novel, with the gun running down in South America. So it took a little research. And again, I love to research. I love learning. So it was, it was fun for me.
I think bringing in, because we have some detectives that are pretty sharp. We have NYPD that's pretty sharp. We have the commander, who's sharp. But obviously the FBI and the CIA do get involved. And I think as a reader, David, that brought a whole nother texture into the story. And it brought in some other characters that are quite interesting. And the relationship of FBI coming in with detectives that are kind of like, hey, we got this, we don't really need you, which we see on some, drama, police procedural dramas, what are they doing here, But it made for very interesting reading, adding these other elements, I thought. Did you think the same?
Yeah, this is not... our book here is really quite interesting because it's not just a simple story of a bad guy. We got a lot of plots worked in here.
So, I wanted to do something other. Yeah. There are a lot of books written about serial killers, and it can be a rather pat genre unless you have something else working. So I thought that would be interesting to bring that in. And since it's something I'm familiar with, it worked out for me.
Yeah. We're going to take one more short break. We're going to step away for just a moment. We are delighted to welcome Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, both sponsors of Rendezvous with a Writer. And if you are a writer, find out what they can do for you. Here's a word from Blue Cottage and Clicks by Madison. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experienced, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We're talking about Mapping the Night with David Vessel. And we're looking at that book right now. You know, there's a lot of interesting characters in the book. Did you want to bring one up?
Well, first, David, thank you so much for providing for the reader. In the beginning, we do have a table of contents, and that can be very helpful if you're trying to go back and find something. You also gave us a glossary of major characters and recurring characters, and I found that was very helpful. And then acronyms, which, you know, is all those things with initials that it's like, you know, the people in the story, they know that, they know what it means, but the reader, you know, that's very helpful. So thank you so much for
you're welcome.
Including those elements. So we thought it might be fun. There are, just as Jim just said, such a wealth of interesting characters. So what we're going to do is kind of call out a name and then tell us a little something about that person. Is that good? Are you a go for that?
Sure.
Okay. Do you want to start with the first names here?
Well, we can, yeah.
A
couple of detectives here. We got Jim Broaden and Jane Levitt.
Known as the Ball and Crow.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us a little.
They're connected. Well, when I'm writing, I'm not really thinking necessarily of developing certain characters. They just kind of develop on their own as I'm writing. But those two are favorite, and I want them to play off against each other. And I think they do fairly well. I mean, they've been partners for years. They can finish each other's sentences. They have a sense of humor. One of them is a little more cynical than the other, and the other is more serious. So it brings in both, you know, all kinds of aspects of police work between the two of them. You have two different approaches to how they go about their business.
Mm-hmm. And their commanding officer, Nadine Robinson, I really liked her, and boy, she plays a kind of major role as we begin to sort of wrap up the story, which we won't go into, except she's a really cool lady. I liked Nadine a lot.
She's a strong character.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. She's a tough cookie, and you need someone that takes command, which she does. She directs them on what she thinks is the right way to proceed, and she has enough chutzpah to deal with the FBI so that they don't walk in and take over the case. They have to work with her, and she wants them to know that you are not taking over my case. You're going to have to work with me if you want this thing to come out right. So I think you needed someone in there to kind of be the maestro, if you will, the conductor of the band. And I think she serves that purpose.
Mm-hmm. And considering there probably aren't a lot of murders on the Upper East Side, you know, you wonder sort of how much experience do these NYPD officers and detectives really have in this kind of crime? They obviously have enough to know what to do, but I think there might have been a comment somewhere early on, or maybe, you know, like, well, what do they know? You know, who gets murdered on the Upper East Side?
Well, the 19th Precinct, which is the one that polices that end of town. My research, if I recall, says that this is kind of a plum assignment. And if you're going to get that, you have to come up through the ranks. You have to do, you have to work in other areas of the city in order to get that assignment. So these people who are not, you know, they didn't just fall out of the sky into the 19th precinct. Yeah. They had to earn that.
Two FBI agents, special agents, Eileen Prado. Oh my goodness, what a tough cookie she is. Tell us about Eileen.
Yeah, Eileen and Fisher are actually two characters in a couple of other books. And as you've read book, so you know that she's had quite a history. She worked for the New Orleans Police Department and had a tough time. She was pretty much left for dead at one point. And when the people that she was working undercover with discovered who she was and almost beat her to death. So she was she has quite a history. And Fisher worked on Capitol. Again, this is a playoff of two characters. Fisher's totally different. He started on Capitol Hill. He's a lawyer. He worked as a lobbyist. So the playoff between someone with her background, Prado's background, which is, you know, which is really down in the dirt, and his background, which comes from more on the ethereal level of working in politics. The two of them together, they make quite a team. And if one of them doesn't see something, the other one will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the one interesting thing is Eileen gets her revenge, doesn't she?
She gets it.
Yes.
It's good to see that, you know. It's good to see the good guys win, you know.
Oh, yeah. That's not a spoiler alert, anybody, that you need to read the book. You'll get where we're at with that one. Do you want to ask about the plaza?
The plaza.
The residence in the plaza?
Yeah, let's talk about the plaza. What's, you know, a lot of people heard about the plaza. A lot of people have been there. But just how special is that place?
The plaza, do you
want to? It's very special. It's a landmark. It's a landmark in New York City. It started out as a hotel that hosted every royalty, both theater and royalty from Europe that you can imagine. They had the Oak Room and they had the Oak Bar, which were very special. Every entertainer who was anybody in New York entertained people at the Oak Room and the Oak Bar. I remember I went there when I was, and that long wood polished wood bar was so special, and the oysters that everybody ate when they went there. I mean, there are just so many things about the Plaza Hotel. And of course now it's I think from floor 11 to 21 is now a condominium, and that's where Warren Winston lives.
Go ahead.
Warren Winston.
Yeah, we talked about him a little bit.
What's about this guy? What's he like? What's his story?
Well, as I said, because of the condition he suffers, he has a very unique outlook on life. And what I did, you'll know, of course, that he's teamed up with a Maddie,
yes,
who is a young lady who lives in the plaza. Also, she lives under different circumstances than he does. She lives in an apartment that's supplied to her by a benefactor. She's 14, and she's actually the daughter of Broaden, the detective. I mean, happenstance.
Yeah.
It's very nice when you're a writer and you can write, make these things happen. But anyway, she's a star student in her high school, and she contracted a very bad case of cancer, and she's dying basically. But she's in the plaza. She's being taken care of by this benefactor who was in the same high school, graduate high school that she's in.
Yeah.
Not puts him in a hotel college, but they couldn't, you know, she can't go to college. So this is the way he's handling things. Anyway, she runs into Warren Winston, running around at night because she's tired of being cooped up in the hotel. She happens to see him one night and starts following him around. So they end up partnering up, and she's a real, you know, one of those people that just says what's ever on her mind. He's much more buttoned up. So between the two of them, and I think she brings out a certain part of his personality that would never show because he'd never run into anybody like her who just says to him, basically, you know, what's the matter with you? You've got so much going on for you, and see it that way. And she says, you know, basically, I'm dying, and I see life from a totally different perspective. And let me tell you, you're wasting yours. So that's the way they play off against each other.
Yeah, she has a real influence on him, which we see as the story develops. And, you know, as she says things to him like, well, why don't you go to the seashore? Well, you could go at night. You know, you don't have to stay here in the city. Mm. There are ways to get places at night. And he has never really, you know, she expands his horizons in a really lovely way. They're really fun together. I love all the scenes with the two of them. Now, there is a the concierge at the Gramercy. Is it, remind me, is it Cecil or Cecil?
Cecil, right?
Does he pronounce
it? Well, he says Cecil. Everybody's calling, yeah. He calls, he said, when they start calling him Cecil, he says, no, no, no. Pronounce my name right. It's Cecil.
Cecil. It is Cecil. We were debating it again last night. He's kind of a minor character. Yeah. Yeah. Tell us a little bit about him.
Well, there. He's a minor character, but he's one of those minor characters that seems to be bigger than is allowed by his presence in the novel. But he also has his presence, the way he conducts himself, is perfect to be a concierge in the hotel because he represents what the hotel is all about. That is being an English gentleman, so to speak. This is what I expect from this hotel. This is the way I conduct myself. Mm-hmm. And this is the way I expect you to conduct yourself when you're talking to me and when you're in this hotel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, you spend enough time in hotels, like, which I did, because I sold products to hotels in days gone by. And you would see fellas just like him. You know, and they've been there for 50 years.
They know everything.
Yeah.
They're like archivists, right?
Yeah, and they're very proud of their job.
Yep,
and
they're
proud of where they work, and they want you to know it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, yeah. So we just took a little in-depth look at characters. Yeah. Now, David, we'd like to talk to you a little bit more about an in-depth look at David's writing process.
Okay.
And you shared a little bit already. You said you come up with a kernel, and it's kind of how you get started.
Right.
You shared with us the other night an interesting similarity to another well-known writer. Who was that?
More songwriter. It's Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. I once read an article where he was describing his composing style, his writing style. And he says, basically, I start with a riff. If you think of, you know, I Can't Get No Satisfaction, that iconic riff at the beginning. He said, I woke up in the middle of the night and this was in my head. So I just went from there. I used that and I wrote the rest of the song. He says, I do that for all my songs. I have a basic thing, you know, a repetitive riff, and then I build on that. And that's the way I write. I have a riff, the riff of the guy, you know, with going in and attacking these poor women. And I just built on that. I just start writing. I don't have an outline. I don't have character studies. Sometimes I don't know what's going to happen on the next page and the next paragraph. I just keep going. And, you know, and I start. And when I'm done, I'm done.
He doesn't use an outline.
No backstories on the characters. Yeah.
No?
So I wonder how he'd answer your question.
Oh yeah, we skip by the characters, but we'll go back. Just one question: did those folks ever surprise you?
When you're writing a character, does the character
the people that I come up with in my novel?
Yeah.
No, they don't really surprise me. I mean, they're just kind of they fit with what writing.
They never argue with you. They never say, "David, I would never say that," or "That's not me. I don't do that." Do they ever give you a hard time? David is still, if you're listening to us, he's still on screen. He's just, we have perhaps just lost him for a moment. He's still with us. We always love to talk about characters and how they surprise us and so forth. And we're waiting for David to just come on back in. So, Jim, was there any character that sort of surprised you, like you thought to yourself, oh, why did he do that? Or why did she do that? Or anything?
You know, it comes towards the end of the book, but Eileen, our FBI agent, I was really amazed that she survived that ordeal from another long time ago. And it was very interesting how she decided she wanted to get revenge.
Oh, yes.
And she sort of got some revenge, but she kind of left it for other people to take care of this character. So you can only imagine how his contemporaries handled him.
Yes.
We're kind of vague about this because we don't want to be a spoiler alert, because, you know, it's kind of an interesting take on solving a problem.
Yes, no. And Nadine Robinson has a little something to do with that, too.
Yes, she does.
To that part of the book. So let's see. Well, we are waiting for David to join us again. In the meantime, we might as well tell you a little bit about what's coming up. This month of September, we have had Mayhem, Memoir, Tonight is Murder.
And Medallion, right?
And next week we'll have Medallion winner. And I'm just going to go ahead and our folks that are joining us tonight. Next week we have award-winning author and illustrator. Here's David. He's back. Hey. Oh, thank you for joining us back again, David.
Thank you for having me.
Let's see. Here's a question for you. Do you get writer's block? And if you do, what do you do, or do you not believe in it?
Oh, I believe it. I believe it happens. It's never happened to me. I've been very fortunate. There are times when I'll be writing along and I'll think to my team, I'm writing myself down a rabbit hole here. Maybe back up and painfully erase a page or two, and then just pick it up again and go from there. I'm the type that I just keep writing. I don't allow myself to think about writer's block. I mean, I will write anything to keep going. Mm-hmm. And then I'll go back and I probably have to clean it all up. Yeah. But I just keep going. I will not allow myself to say, oh my gosh, I have writer's block, or I can't, you know, where do I go next? I don't even think about it. I just keep going until I get back to the flow.
Mm-hmm. Good advice. Yeah. So where can people find you, follow you, get the book, help us out?
Okay. They can find my books on, of course, Amazon. I think Barnes & Noble as well. You just type in John David Bethel and you'll get all my books. I'm on Facebook. If you know a little thing on Facebook where they say, if you want to find someone, how do you find them? Just type in my name, John David Bethel, and you'll find me. And I guess also on Goodreads. I'm also listed on Goodreads. So there are all kinds of places you can find me.
And what's coming next?
Well, actually, I've been writing another book. I just got to the end of the first draft. So that should be, I don't know, took me 4 months to write the first draft, which is about right. It takes 4 to 6 months to write the first draft. Then I spend another 2 months rewriting. So, you know, I've got it in the pocket, and it should be ready here in a little bit.
All right. Jim, you have a quote.
We have one more quote.
One more quote.
From the book.
Okay.
This is from The Dancing Man. Getting strong now. Won't be long now. Getting strong now. Gonna fly now. Flying high now. Gonna fly, fly. This is the last one for now. After tonight, Max is done.
We've been talking to author David Bethel, and it's been so much fun. And the fun will continue next week. Don't go away, David. Next week. Okay. We will be joined by a medallion winner, and that will wrap the month of September. Joni Franks is with us. She is an award-winning children's author and illustrator, and we have three fairly new books. One has just been released that we'll be talking about. She's our featured guest, but also next week we will roll out the first of a new segment that we're adding. It will happen at the very top of the hour. And we will have a returning author friend who is also a medallion winner, W. Michael Farmer. And he just sent us one of his latest books, Proud Outcast. Yeah. He'll be with us just at the very top of the hour. We have found that many of our alumni have published things. And David, now you're an alumni since the last time they were with us, and we're trying to figure out how we can keep in touch with them, give them a chance to share what they have going on. So join us next week. Do you have any other closing thoughts?
That's it, right? It's always a great day out west.
Keep writing, and we'll
thank you.
Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, David.
My pleasure.